Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you're enjoying your lunch. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm with the Board of Governors here at the FCC and Reuters. Before we get started, a few quick housekeeping notes. Please remember to switch your mobile phones back on when you leave the building today. And also, just to tell you about some upcoming events and lunches that we have at the FCC. Next week, we have two events, lunches, both of them. The first one is Nan Sussman, who'll be speaking on the 6th of June. She'll be talking about reverse immigration and how people leave countries and then tend to come back. The talk is entitled Blended or Bicultural, What Happens to Boomerangs and Sea Turtles? And then the following day, we'll have Carol T. Crist, who's the president of Smith College in the States. She'll be speaking about the world's sudden surge of women political leaders. So if you have some interest, please do sign up. We'd love to see you come along. Now, on to events of today, and Ruchir Sharma, the author of Breakout Nations, here to speak with us. A little earlier, he was talking about the fad of emerging markets and how fads come and go. He also thinks growth in China is really going to slow and stay put for a while. So for all of us here in Hong Kong who base our work lives around China, that might be slightly hard to digest. But we look forward to hearing from him about his new book, Ruchir.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be back here. I think the last time that I was here at this August venue was during the East Asian financial crisis to hear a talk then back in 1997. And obviously there are, as I was discussing with a couple of people here, that there are a lot of echoes today in terms of what's happening in Europe and what happened back in East Asia back in 97, 98. That's not the main topic of my book, even though I do talk about the fact that how East Asia was possibly better served in 97-98 by the fact that there were, you know, that you had a lot of very sharp economic contractions that took place in the region, economic hard landings, as we call them, from Korea to Indonesia. And those countries really emerged much stronger and better after those hard landings. And I think the problem in the developed world often, and we're seeing this even today in Europe, and we saw this in Japan in particular over the last 2 decades, the tendency to amortize pain over time, which really means you never sort the mess out, and the problems just drag on for a long period of time, unlike what we saw here in East Asia, where the countries that did sort of take it on the chin, and of course, yeah, there was a lot of bad press those days about the advice Indonesia got, etc. But in the end, those are the economies that really bounce back in the most pronounced manner. And for me, Indonesia, in fact, today is one of the breakout nations in the book that I've just written. So like I've been an investor for a long period of time. I've been investing in emerging markets for nearly 2 decades now. But I've been a writer for longer than I've been an investor. While my day job has been to sort of invest in all these developing countries, I've been writing for 2 decades for various publications around the world. I was a contributing editor for Newsweek for much of the last decade. I wrote a column for them on the side, and of course, I've written op-eds for various publications. So I really sort of enjoy writing, and I find lots of parallels between investing and being a journalist. As I was mentioning to Tara just now, that what I try and do is to spend 1 week a month in each emerging market, soaking it in, obsessing about that country. So after having written these columns for a long period of time and op-eds, like most writers, I believe that I had a book in me. And so I decided to write this book at the end of it and spend much of last year writing it. But writing a book is always an intimidating task, because writing an op-ed or column is 1,000 words, writing a book is 100,000 words at least. And I was in search of a big idea, a big unifying idea, that even though I wanted to write an economic travelogue, and that's what this book is, I was in search of a big idea. And some events happened in late 2010, which set the stage for this big idea of the book, the big unifying idea, even though it's broken down as an economic travelogue. One of the more memorable incidents, in fact, with which I also begin the book, was in late 2010 that I'd gone back to India. I'm based in New York, but I went back to India on one of my frequent visits there. And I was dragged into one of these famously decadent farmhouse parties, as they call them in Delhi. The farmers have long left the farmhouses of Delhi, but the lands were given out on concessional rates to people there, and the rich now have taken them over as their playgrounds. So they, you know, these are the Hamptons of Delhi, so to speak, where you, like, you go about 45 minutes or an hour outside of Delhi, and you get these sprawling mansions with lots of fancy features, you know, from water fountains, and this one that I went to had a railroad running around it as well. So, you know, quite a fancy place, and they would really, you know, really had laid it out there with chefs flown in from different parts of the world. Outside, the valets were juggling the Bentleys and the Jaguars and stuff. So it was a fancy scene, and I got roped in there because it was the festive time of Diwali, and I'd gone back for that, and so I went in for this party. And in the midst of that pulsating techno music that was going on in the background, I got chatting with this young 25-year-old who was there. He was a typical sort of Delhi type, as I call them, because, you know, like wearing a tight black T-shirt, you know, like chest hugging, hair gelled, spike, you know, like spiked up a bit. And he got chatting with me, and you know, I mean, had a bit of an attitude, and he sussed who I am, and he figured out that I was a global investor back in India. That's how he wanted to see it. And you know, like, he looked at me, and this was the peak of the emerging market boom in late 2010, when capital flows into emerging markets were coming in, and a lot of people in my community were talking about how this is the next bubble and how this is going to sort of, you know, just keep running and running. And so this guy sort of, you know, after being the son of some Delhi exporter, sort of got chatting with me, and then he looks at me and shrugs his shoulders and says, "Where else will the money go?" You know, the sort of overconfidence, cockiness that you're back here in India, you have to be, the West is in decline, the money has to come to, you know, countries such as India, where else is it going to go? And that sort of, you know, set me thinking, because if anything that we have learned in our investing careers, having seen so many cycles, is that the, you know, this mantra which I've sort of always followed, that the inevitable never happens, the unexpected does. That really is the sum, and that the past is not the prologue. Those are the two things that you try and keep in mind. And when he made this statement to me, my sort of mind started to flash back about how it was a decade ago. And a decade ago, nobody wanted to speak about emerging markets. I was still doing emerging markets, but people were like, why should we invest in these rat-infested, you know, like, you know, kind of places, you know, the, you know, where there's all risk and no real return. We put so much money here. This was back in, like, 99, after we had the East Asian financial crisis, the Mexican crisis. It was a serial crisis in the 1990s in emerging markets, and that was the narrative as far as emerging markets were concerned. And even my colleagues were sort of so tired of trying to sell emerging markets that one of them came up with this innovative idea of rechristening emerging markets as emerging markets, which is the, you know, peak of the tech boom in like 2000, and the only way that you could sell emerging markets then was to, you know, get some stardust from the tech boom and to reposition it as emerging markets because of all the sort of hype coming out of the Silicon Valley and the tech startups back then. So that was the sentiment like a decade ago, and here I was a decade later, and the sort of confidence here was, you know, where else is the money going to go? And just at that point in time, a couple of other sort of incidents took place back then. I'd gone to Moscow for one of my regular sort of meetings in Moscow, and there was a conference that was going on, and the conference organizers knew that I was there, and Putin too was going to be there at this conference. So the conference organizers suggested, like, to me about making a presentation there, because Putin's office was keen that a large foreign investor make a presentation at this conference to Putin about what the state of Russia is. So they asked me about it. My neighbor suggested, and, you know, Putin in his office said, "Yeah, fine, he'll make the presentation." So there I was in Moscow in October 2010 making a presentation about the state of Russia. And I wasn't quite prepared for this, because as an investor, I'm used to, you know, just talking bluntly. I did not know that this is going to be a big deal, because, you know, like, the, you know, TV cameras were around, it was being telecast, etc. Putin was, you know, there on the stage. I made this, you know, very blunt presentation about what, you know, like the state of Russia, and as to how I used to be optimistic on Russia like a decade ago, but today, you know, like I've turned pessimistic on Russia, and why I've turned pessimistic, that they've really done nothing to diversify outside oil and gas, and the challenges of an economy at a per capita income of $12,000 are very different than an economy of $2,000-$3,000, which is where Russia was after the crisis back in 1999-2000. So I made this really blunt presentation and stuff, and at that point in time, I thought it was okay. Putin was there taking notes. He referred to it and stuff like that. But the next day, the entire media out there, you know, went after me, basically sort of, you know, like obviously sort of at the behest of the Kremlin and stuff. And the entire media sort of take was that, you know, who needs your money, right? Because, you know, like here's this like foreign investor talking to us, but you've got enough capital coming in. You know, who needs this money? So, you know, like it was very dismissive of that. And shortly after that, there was a client conference that we had for our clients back in the U.S. And I was asked, you know, then to sort of, you know, do a fireside chat with George Bush, like who was a guest speaker there. And at the firm's behalf, I was doing this like a fireside chat with him. And I was a bit sort of stung by my experience in Moscow in terms of the sort of rather nasty send-off I got after that speech. And so, like, in that talk, I asked, you know, like, Bush, that, listen, you were really optimistic on Putin, you know, that you sort of said how you you looked him in the eye and that he was, I mean, like a true friend. And, you know, what do you think of Putin now in terms of given, you know, like how he's done and how, you know, like his entire narrative has changed and his discourse has changed. So, you know, Bush sort of, you know, told me that, listen, when I first met Putin back in 2000, et cetera, he used to talk about, you know, like getting his debt levels down. They were concerned that oil prices may fall. This was when the price of oil was about $25 a barrel and it would fall to $15 and what would happen. And they wanted to avoid another crisis. They wanted to pay back their debt. They had, you know, they had a new stabilization fund. And he said, you know, like he was a very different guy. And in 2007, 2008, you know, when I would meet him, he was a totally changed person, that he was needling me about my mortgage-backed securities and what was going on. And he said, you know, there was a perfect anecdote which captured this. He said that when he went, you know, when Putin came to the White House back in 2000, 2001, you know, sometime then, his dog Barney was playing around there, you know, Bush's dog and stuff. And Putin sort of, you know, like didn't pay much attention to everybody, you know, but he was playing around and stuff. He said, you know, then I went back to Moscow in 2007 or something, or 2008, it was early 2008, and Putin like invited me to his dacha. So I went to his dacha, and he said, in the middle of it, he basically sort of tells me, do you want to see my dog? So, you know, Bush says, okay, fine, you know, let's see your dog. And he says, like, out came this, you know, huge dog, and, you know, Putin goes to him, bigger, better, stronger, right? So he said, no, this was the incredible change in sentiment as far as Putin's concerned. After a decade of success and stuff, this is the language that he was talking about now. So all these things, I mean, happened almost at the same time, within almost, you know, like a few weeks of each other. And for me, I had the big idea for my book, which is that, listen, I think I've studied a bit of economic history, and the game of economic development is not as easy as we've all come to believe at the end of 2010, when the sentiment really was that if you're an emerging market, you're bound to grow at a much faster pace and converge with the developed world. That really had come to be the sentiment back then. And you know, this had come to be because the past decade was truly a freaky decade for emerging markets. We had never seen something like this ever in the history of economic development. And what was that? Which is that every single developing country experienced some sort of a boom over the past decade, almost every single country. In any particular year, if you look at economic history, around 20% of economies experience a negative GDP growth rate. And only about 1 in 3 experience a growth rate of more than 5%. In the peak year of 2007, before the financial crisis, only 3 countries tracked by the IMF, about, you know, there were 180-odd countries that the IMF tracked, experienced a negative GDP growth rate. Not 20%, which is typical in any year in the history of economic development, but only 3 countries. And which were those 3? Zimbabwe, Fiji, Congo. Who cares, right? So that was the sort of, you know, like, thing we had. And more than 50% of economies in that year experienced a growth rate of more than 5%. And you know, this was like truly exceptional. So it set me thinking that why did we have such an exceptional decade? And this is not the history of economic development. And I think, you know, there were 2 to 3 reasons as to why we had this very exceptional decade last decade. One was that emerging markets had experienced a very tough spell in the 1980s and 1990s. That save China, many other emerging markets were struggling to grow. The average growth rate of emerging markets in the 1990s was barely 3.5%. And this is why investing in emerging markets became so sort of unappealing, because the US was growing at more than 3% that decade. So the US is growing at 3, and emerging markets are doing a bit more than that. Why bother, right? Because the risk return, you know, like, favors the US much more. So we had this sort of entire sort of favor of the US, and emerging markets went through these serial crises in the 1990s, starting with Mexico and ending with Argentina, but, you know, like, with Russia and East Asia captured within that. And the other reason, I think, and this is, I think, less well understood, is that capital flow to emerging markets really was at a record pace from 2003 onwards. I think this is the point that is not examined enough, which is what happened in 2003 that the growth rates of emerging markets suddenly took off. Because before that, you know, like, even in places like India, like, this question is asked, and I think not answered. India carried out its landmark reforms in the year 1991, or in the early 1990s. There was no acceleration in India's economic growth rate till 2003. It was essentially the same. Then all of a sudden in 2003, India's economic growth rate shot up from what was a, you know, pretty steady 5.5% to like 6% to nearly 9%. And it held that way for many years after that. And that was true for country after country. And I think what happened then was that a lot of the easy money from the Fed and from the West that was flowing out, a lot of that flew into emerging markets as well. And the cost of capital was really low in that period. So now this has been analyzed as something in terms of like how it created the housing bubble in the US and in Southern Europe, what all it did. But I think not enough attention has been paid that how this flow of easy money inflated growth rates in emerging markets too, to much above their historical mean. The historical mean has been about 5%. The 1990s was a dark period of just 3.5%. But the average growth rate from 03 to 07, the really boom golden years in emerging markets, the average annualized growth rate was just above 7.5%. And this was a unique period in economic history, that we've never seen so many countries boom in unison. And it led to a lot of talk about how, you know, like, this was inevitable, that all, you know, that if you're an emerging market, you were bound to converge with the developed world. And I could see the sentiment tracked as far as India is concerned or other places were concerned, I mean, for emerging markets. I mean, as I said, like in 2000 there was no hope in hell that you could raise money in emerging markets. By 2005, any man and his dog could raise money in, you know, I mean, like, in emerging markets. And by 2010, just the dog would do, right? And I think that's you know, that's really what we saw in this entire period. So this is how, like, I set out, but the you know, that the history of economic development is that there are more failures than there are successes. There are 180 odd economies today in the world which are tracked by the IMF. Only 35 are developed. Everyone else is emerging. Everyone else tends to have a promising decade, which we try and extrapolate like into the future, and then that decade never quite works out because you know, like, they stumble, they make some mistakes. You know, I mean, the classic cases are the Brazils and the Mexicos, or you got countries like Argentina and stuff like that, which sort of, you know, like, are developed at some point and then slide all the way back down. So very few countries are able to make the cut to becoming developed countries. It's a circular process. And I think that's the era that we're getting into now, which is that the growth rates across emerging markets have been slowing down over the past couple of years. A lot of this is sort of attributed to the fact, oh, there's a crisis in Europe, there's a, you know, that the US is slowing down, et cetera. Yes, but it also tells you the fact that this is a change environment now, that very easy money that was available out there, you know, like, to be able to grow is no longer available for many of these countries. And secondly, that a lot of these countries, after a very successful decade, have begun to make mistakes because they took that decade to mean that it was a permanent levitation act. And I think that's what's going on. So this year, for example, Brazil's economic growth rate. Now, this was a big celebrated economy of Latin America. Brazil's economic growth rate, I think that they'll be lucky if they do anything above 2%. I think that you look at Russia. I think Russia will be lucky if they get to 4%. I think India will be lucky if it you know, like, retains a growth rate of above 6%. So there's a big slowdown happening here. And the same thing is going on in China for a somewhat different reason as well. in terms of what's happening in China. That China, the economic growth rate now is also slowing down. And this is perfectly natural. China, like in some regard, ways is a victim of its own success. That China's economic growth rate for the past three decades has been 10% on average. But its per capita income level today is now around $6,000. And if you adjust for exchange rates, this is exactly the level at which Japan, Korea, Taiwan, the gold medalists of growth, as I call them, because these were the successful economies that went on to grow and avoid any middle-income trap, all these economies at this stage of economic development and this per capita income level began to slow down. And they downshifted all by about 4 percentage points or so, roughly in that ballpark. So Japan's growth rates in the 1970s slowed down from about 9% to about 5%. Korea, Taiwan in the 80s and 90s followed a similar path. And I think that that's where China is today, because as you get sort of bigger and richer, you run out of many sort of low growth drivers. Like in China's case, for the first time, the urbanization ratio now is at 50%. So that pace slows down quite a bit. And then you've got all sorts of other, things there. Exports as a share of the global economy is at 10% now for China. That's exactly where Japan was at the peak of its boom, and it's very hard to grow export shares as a part of the global economy beyond that. Then, of course, all of us have, clearly discussed and overanalyzed the investment boom in China. But what's less well understood, as this entire debate is going on today about whether China will have another stimulus or not, is the fact that China's total debt in the system as a share of its GDP is quite high. And so that's what makes any further stimulus from here really dangerous and possibly not workable. That China's total debt as a share of its GDP today in the entire system, and this is not any controversial accounting, just a plain addition of everything, is about 180 to 200% or so currently. And the big mistake that I think a lot of us make is that we talk about the US ratio of being above 300%, the total debt in the system, but we never adjust for per capita income levels. And I think that's a mistake we make. For example, that the US at 350% or whatever that number is, that ratio is in fact less out of whack compared to China's ratio at 200% for a country with a per capita income of only $6,000. The basic economic theory being that the richer you are, the greater is your debt to GDP ratio typically, and that because you have more wealth to offset it. So I think that in China's case, the total debt to GDP ratio is already quite high, and so therefore any stimulus that you put to work out here is unlikely to produce much bang for the buck, apart from sort of exacerbating some of the imbalances that we have. The other big myth I hear about China, and I find this amazing how many economists sort of repeat this, is the fact that China needs to rebalance its economy. It needs to rebalance towards consumption, away from exports and investment. And this is almost seen as a way that this is a way that China can keep growing at 8%. Now the fact of the matter is that China's consumption pace has been quite high. China's consumption growth in real terms over the past decade has been about 8%. The only reason why consumption as a share of its GDP is so low is because exports and investment have been growing at an even faster pace. Now, if you look at Japan, Korea, Taiwan, their consumption rates never grew at above 8%, because it's very hard for consumption to grow at such a fast-moving pace. Consumption is a steadier function. But exports and investment tend to be much more high-growth drivers. So the way I feel that China's economy will rebalance is not because consumption will accelerate. I think it's going to happen with the way that consumption remains steady at best, but exports and investments begin to slow down. And as that slows down, consumption as a share of GDP will increase and normalize, from 35% or whatever it is today to 50% over the next decade or two. But investment and exports will really slow down. So the convergence or the rebalancing will happen on the downside, not on the upside, as I think many of us wanted to believe that's going to happen. So I think that this is the entire issue, that when I look at emerging markets today and I go them one by one by one, and I think that's the way to do it, because to treat emerging markets as a homogeneous entity is just the wrong way. Emerging markets today are 40% of the global economy, and it's a very disparate bunch. You've got some sort of countries with a per capita income of $1,000 or $1,500 like India. You've got other countries like Korea, Taiwan counted in this class with a per capita income of more than $20,000. To talk about all these countries in the same breath, and almost as if they have the same sort of outlook, is just is just not right. Like in the book that I point out, that in any year, only 1/3 of economies are able to grow at above 5%. The odds that they're able to sustain that growth rate for a second decade, the same economies, fall to 1/4. The odds that they can sustain that same growth rate for 3 decades falls to 1/10. Only 6 economies in the world have been able to grow at an average annual pace of 5% for 4 decades, and only 2 for 5 decades in a row, and those 2 being Korea and Taiwan. So those are the real gold medalists of growth. But everyone else tends to falter. You know, like, they don't get to 5%, or they do 5%. For example, if you look at the high growth economies of the 1950s and 1960s, there would be Iran, Iraq, Yemen, a lot of, very different economies than we'd imagine today. Whereas half the countries that grew at above 5% over the past decade were economies that had never done so ever in their economic history. So the whole process is one of churn. It's a game that I call of snakes and ladders, which is that you sort of, you know, go up a bit, you get bitten by a snake, you fall back down, you try and find the ladder to try and go back up, but there's no straight line extrapolation. So the concept of breakout nations really is that you got to treat emerging markets as individual entities, which is, you know, take it country by country by country. This rising tide of global liquidity that lifted every single emerging market over the past decade is not going to be around anymore, because a lot of the Western institutions which lent to these emerging markets are not going to be in a position to do so, and there's no substitute for that. And that many of these emerging markets are now falling for their own hype or making their own mistakes. India is a classic case in terms of, you know, how things have, you know, turned sour so quickly for a country that was destined to be the fastest growing economy in the world this decade. That even at a low per capita income like that, you can make so many mistakes. And so therefore the growth now is back down to 6% or so. And I think that the other thing is about expectations. You know, like, people ask this question, okay, fine, if India grows at 6%, that's still decent, right? Because after all, the Western world is going to grow at 1% or 2% or something. But I think here, the real key thing is expectations, that for a country like India to grow at 6% feels like a mini recession out there, because expectations that come to be that India will grow at 8% to 9%. As an investor, we certainly feel that, because companies' profit margins, et cetera, are all sort of priced in for growth rates of like 8 to 9%. And, you know, when it falls off, that really has a, you know, big negative effect. In China's case, I find it staggering. You know, the most amazing statistic I find about China is this as an investor, that the MSCI China Index, which is what people track a lot, was conceived in 1995. This is about Chinese companies listed in Hong Kong, you know, which you can sort of invest in. And you know what's been the total return of the MSCI China Index since 1995? Zero. So we've had this amazing boom in China, and the total returns from the stock market out there have been zero. And I think that, you know, that and that's the problem even today, which is that if you look at the, like in China, that the moment economic growth there slips below 8%, the profitability of companies turns negative, which is that, you know, like, there's a decline in the total profit growth in China the moment you go below 8% or so. Now, in most countries, of course, there's a good relationship between GDP growth rates and in terms of stock market performance. For the past decade, that relationship has been relatively good as the stock markets have become more aligned. But in China's case, it is a real outlier in terms of what happens. So breakout nations, for me, now the whole concept here is that we need to sort of look out for countries that are likely to exceed expectations over the coming few years. And here I've been very careful about keeping the time horizon reasonable. Like I say in the book, that the old rule of forecasting used to be that you make as many forecasts as possible and you remind people when you're right. I mean, the new rule of forecasting is that you make forecasts so much out in the future that neither you nor I will be held accountable for those, right? So therefore, this is a very fashionable talk now that we'll talk about 2030, 2050, the world will be this, etc. Hey, I'd love to get a client who'd come and tell me, I'll check your performance in 2030. I'm sure there are politicians who'd love to come and tell us that we'd love to, that you elect us based on what we deliver to you in 2030 and leave us alone till then. So I find such futurology to be very titillating, but to be totally meaningless, because it's not practical for us to be making such forecasts. And also that regimes tend to shift so abruptly and so quickly, which is that, a country that was doing well for a decade, as I just mentioned, can so quickly sputter. So, I mean, to make these long-term forecasts beyond a practical time horizon, which I think is about 3 to 5 years, is pointless. So in this economic travelogue, as I go around the world, I try and come up with which countries are going to exceed expectations compared to where expectations are today. I think that there's hope in, for Southeast Asia. Some of the countries I mentioned that are controversial, like I speak about Philippines, even the Filipinos can't believe that I've spotted them. So, there's a lot of sort of incredulity in the press there that why I think Philippines is staging a comeback after being out in the wilderness for so long. I talk about the fact that, that Indonesia is still doing things right, about Thailand maybe getting its politics right at last. I speak about some countries in Eastern Europe, such as Poland, which have suffered collateral damage because of the problems in Europe, which may still look promising. There's Turkey, which I think is emerging as a real sort of serious regional player. And I think the fact that Turkey and Indonesia will be the next two economies to be part of the trillion-dollar club. There are about 15 economies today which are about $1 trillion in size in the world. The next two to join that club to me will be Turkey and Indonesia. The fact that they're Muslim democracies, I think, has very positive signaling effects out there. I think some of the frontier markets look appealing, such as Nigeria, because they have a leader who's not pilfering oil wealth. And you got sort of, some comeback stories, like smaller countries like Sri Lanka, because they are sort of getting the peace dividend. But when I look at some of these big emerging markets, that's where I feel a bit worried about, because expectations got too high. And I think that, the big problem also I find, and this is what I try and say like in Breakout Nations, is that we have to be flexible. The problem I have with acronyms is that, you get locked into views. So I keep hearing people on this whole BRIC topic. As I said, BRIC, simply became popular because its timing was great. Every single emerging market did well over the past decade, and BRIC captured the four largest. So it became a very popular term because of that. But today, I just find the people who sort of created this term sort of, twisting themselves to defend why Russia, should, still be a part of it when the whole world thinks it shouldn't, et cetera. But once you form an acronym, it's so hard to sort of, entangle yourself out of it because, BIC doesn't sound as cool as BRIC does. And then at the end of the decade, also what I found was some new acronyms came into play. And this was the acronym craze because every single emerging market was doing well. The one that I found the most amusing was something called CIVETS. This is what one of the banks came up with. And CIVETS was basically, after the name of some cat or something, I'm told. And what are the countries that were captured in CIVETS? Colombia, Indonesia, Vietnam, Egypt, Thailand. Basically anything goes, right? You stick it in, you throw the spaghetti at the wall, it'll stick. Every emerging market's doing well, so you coin the acronym, you stick it, and it's going to sort of do well.
Ruchir, speaking of acronyms, I want to make sure we don't go OT over time. Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left for questions. So,
I'm happy to conclude and open the floor to questions. I can go on, as you can see, about this topic. So I think that the whole sort of point here is that to do an economic travelogue, to come up with easy-to-follow rules of the road as to which ones will be. I have a Four Seasons Index, a Billionaires Index, that you sort of try and look at which economies will do well and which will not. And then, but the whole key thing here is to realize that the last decade was a freaky decade. Not every emerging market is destined to sort of converge with the developed world. And we've got to look at emerging markets now on an individual basis, country by country. Thanks.
Thank you. Up to you. So we do have about 10 minutes for question and answers. If you want to raise your hand, we have a microphone. Tell us your name and your organization. Right over here.
Thanks for the great presentation. My name is William from Hammond Investment Group. I just want to point out, it seems that you prefer the smaller economies at the moment, that Indonesia or Turkey would to become the next emerging market economies, while you think that the China or India has been ex-growth. But if you're looking back, that the U.S. and Japan has been undergoing the older road, they also come across this 5,000, 6,000 GDP per capita road. And obviously, why you think China or India cannot cross this line? And what ingredients you think is lacking? And why the history cannot repeat?
I don't think that China will not cross the line. All I'm trying to say is that the expectations of China are very high, that it's likely to experience something which I call a middle income deceleration, not a middle income trap. So that's not my case at all. My case here is about expectations that both India and China should, over the next 3 to 5 years, be able to grow at 6%, which is a pretty decent growth rate. But the problem with that is that expectations out of those economies had come to be so high that that's going to feel like a disappointment to many people. So that's my point here, that this is relative to expectations, not in absolute terms. Like, as I said, like in China's case, it's amazing. You know, like among investors, this is a great question I find, that in these polls that are carried out, people ask the question, will China have a hard landing? And I find the response to this sort of amusing in two regards. One is, how do they define a hard landing for China? It's 7% growth or less. And two, how many people say that China will not have a hard landing in these polls? It's basically 80% or something, because they all think that the growth rate will be above 7%. So this has got to do with expectations more than anything else, not about some new economic superpowers, you know, that are going to emerge.
Is very low.
Yeah, I think that capital markets expectations, I'm not sure if they're low, because they've still poured money into China and the Chinese equity market despite zero returns. So I think that the expectation, but I'm talking about investor expectations here, that I think that, you know, this is subjective, but I think that investor expectations are still out of China. I mean, even today, of the surveys that I see, China still ranks as the biggest overweight today. Among all fund managers in their global positioning.
Further questions? Over here. I'll go to George first and then over here.
Thanks, Tara. George Chen from South China Morning Post. Very interesting views on emerging markets. I just have one question, you know, if you can talk more about China. If I understand correctly, you suggest that China should slow down the export and just maintain the domestic consumption, you know, at a certain level. But I mean, I'm not an economist, but I try to think it in a simple perspective. I mean, say if China is a company, then basically you want to make the cake bigger. And in the meantime, you have smaller export. And on the other side, it's very difficult, everybody knows, to even maintain the domestic consumption, given, you know, the inflation or the problems. What's the solution to that? And the other thing is, the government has been talking about the rebalancing of economy for ages. I mean, this is certainly not a new idea. I mean, since I went to university, actually. Is there any insight on how they can really make something happen to effectively rebalance the economy? Thanks.
Yeah, I don't think it's in the government's power to rebalance it. I mean, I just think it's going to be a natural thing which is going to happen. So I think that exports and investment will slow down and consumption hopefully can hold up. And because they have some measures to boost consumption, they can do that. But I don't think that it is in the government's control to rebalance the economy. I think it's a natural thing which is going to happen, just because exports and investment are going to slow down quite significantly. I don't think the government here is something which can engineer this. This is something which is a natural thing which needs to happen.
The government for the very big part. Don't you think the government should have a role, you know, or to some extent they should do something, you know, in certain measures to help rebalance it? Or you think it just let the market do it, like the Wall Street, what they believe?
No, I think that the government, you know, still needs to do stuff to hold up consumption, because I think if exports and investments slow down, that will have collateral negative impact on consumption. I think we're already seeing it just now. Some of the consumption data out of China in the past few weeks has been quite disappointing. So I think what the government needs to do is to make sure that consumption holds up. But the really dangerous thing will happen in China, and I think, you know, is that if they put into a place here another big stimulus, because nothing will throw the economy out of whack more than if they decide to do another big stimulus just now, because that will, you know, definitely delay any rebalancing and lead to, you know, what could be a real problem pretty soon, maybe like even a year down the road. So I think that what they need to do is to sort of accept the fact that the growth rates are slowing down across the board because they've become a more mature economy. But if they do another stimulus at this point in time, I think nothing will be worse and more counterproductive than that.
We have a question over here, Jane, and then over there.
Jane Singer with Inside Fashion. That was a wonderful presentation. Really appreciated your insights. I'm just wondering if you could touch on your views on Myanmar. It's getting an awful lot of play in the media lately.
I'm so happy that you brought that up, because I think that to me, one of the most underreported stories in the region is whatever happened to Vietnam. And, like, I'm always scared about when I hear about the hype about Myanmar. I'm always, you know, like, like remember Vietnam. You know, Vietnam is supposed to be the next China. I mean, as we all know, and we all poured billions of dollars into that country. We hosed it with capital, and they were never able to manage that capital that well, and had a classic boom bust cycle. So I find that, you know, Myanmar is a really nice exotic argument, but I really think that for, you know, that it's too small to matter. And my fear is that we prematurely thrust greatness upon it, like we did with Vietnam. So I think that the real thing to it, like remember here every time, you know, someone tells me about, everyone, you know, speaks to me about Myanmar, is that, hey, whatever happened to Vietnam, which was also supposed to sort of be the next big hope. So yeah, I mean, I'm not holding my breath for Myanmar's emergence.
Okay, we'll sneak in a couple more questions. Lady in red over here, and then one more.
Hi, thank you. My name's Sarah. I'm with the Financial Times. Just a question about the comment that you made about Indonesia and Turkey being sort of next up-and-coming countries. You mentioned specifically that they're Muslim democracies. And I think that's quite interesting in the light of what we're hearing about India now, which is that one of the biggest problems the country's having is political deadlock because it is a democracy. I mean, I'm American. You could say that to me about America, though it's not an emerging economy. And I was just wondering to what extent you think about the political system as a democracy in Turkey and Indonesia as sort of mattering either on the, you know, upside or downside to your prognosis for the country's futures?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question because I knew that would come up. So in the book, I have a whole section on this, basically whether democracy or authoritarian regimes are better for growth. And here's the result, you know, that I came up with. We looked at, you know, like 120 high growth cases over the past three decades. And, you know, by high growth, I defined as a country which was able to grow at above 5% for a decade. And the result we came up, you know with was amazing, 50-50. Which is, if you look at the high growth cases over the past three decades, the fact that whether they were an authoritarian or a democratic regime, the odds are exactly 50-50. So my entire point here being that whether you're a democracy or an authoritarian regime, it has no consequences per se for economic growth. What matters, obviously, is the quality of leadership at the top. That for every command and control economy that succeeds, like China, there is a Vietnam, which is a failure. And for democracy, of course, you know, there's so many cases of successes matched by failures. So it's a 50-50 thing.
We have time for one more back here.
Hi, I'm Nishant from Reuters. How much money Southeast Asia can take in? If you see money invested through mutual fund, you know, Southeast Asia, all the countries taken together, just about $25, $30 billion invested. If you take India alone, it's about $50 billion. You know, you can get in Southeast Asia. Can you get out equally successfully?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, like 2 points here. One, that, trust me, not much money is available these days to take in. And I don't think that's changing anytime soon. So, you know, whatever money is available now, it will be taken in. Plus, the other thing I find about liquidity is that it's very pro-cyclical, which is that usually when liquidity is not there, it's almost a good sign. It suggests that market or country is being ignored. And when there's too much liquidity, like we saw in India, by 2010, it's almost a negative sign from a contrarian standpoint. So I find that Southeast Asia, to me, I mean, like, no country today is facing the problem of plenty. The capital in general is much more scarce. And so whatever capital can go into a country, that's great. And I also find that the other thing is that, you know, people talk to me that you're not that optimistic on these BRIC markets. So does that mean that you're not optimistic on emerging markets? And here my line is that, listen, something new will always emerge. Like for us who have done this for a long time, we tend to forget that in the mid-1990s, the two biggest markets to invest in were Malaysia and Thailand. They were 30% of the emerging market universe, 30 of the equity universe. And they came to be 5% a decade after that. So something changes. Something new will always come, and liquidity is very pro-cyclical. But today the problem is, I just don't think there's enough money flowing out of the West, and I don't see that changing anytime soon.
It's 2:00, so we're going to call a hard stop. Ruchir Sharma, thanks very much for your time. And you can come up and ask some questions at 2:00. But before we go, I'd like to present a gift on behalf of the FCC. Thanks very much for coming.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Some good lines. How long were you in town with you?